From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, with Brett Kavanaugh's Supreme Court confirmation hearing underway, we meet the directors of Reversing Roe, a new documentary about the abortion debate.
You know, I don't think we have these conversations enough with people who have different views and values that are perceived around this issue. And I think that's the problem.
Then in White Boy Rick, Matthew McConaughey plays a father whose family can't escape crime.
It was Biden time. He said, come on, man, we might get out of this. I just played my last hand, man. We might get out of here before they bust up the poker party. No, didn't happen.
All that coming right up. Over Labor Day weekend, filmmakers and film lovers traveled from around the globe to gather in Telluride, Colorado, for that mountain town's annual film festival. Among this year's premieres was a documentary that has particular resonance today as the Senate Judiciary Committee embarks on the Brett Kavanaugh hearings.
You've been nominated to the highest court in the land, and your decisions as a potential swing vote could overturn even well-settled precedent. And there are indications in your writings, your opinions, as well as the articles you've written and some of the memos that have come to light, that you believe, for example, Roe v. Wade could be overturned. And that's why I want to know from you whether you think it was correctly decided.
That was Senator Richard Blumenthal from Connecticut earlier today asking Kavanaugh about Roe versus Wade, the landmark 1973 Supreme Court case that decriminalized abortion. Donald Trump pledged during his presidential campaign that he would only appoint justices who would overturn the ruling. The documentary Reversing Roe, using interviews and archival footage, seeks to tell the story of how abortion became such a divisive and political issue. Directors Ricky Stern and Annie Sundberg began production in January of 2017 by first documenting Trump's inauguration, then the Women's March, followed by the annual March for Life. When I met with the directors in Telluride over the weekend, they told me that their intention was to place the abortion debate in context. Here's Ricky Stern.
The title Reversing Roe was really important to us to get to that place, to find a title. Because when we first approached the film starting in 2017, we want to make a film about abortion and how it has become so politicized and divisive and partisan in politics. How did we get here? You know, we grew up in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and we lived through when abortion was illegal, through the time when it became legal. And how have we come to a place now where it has become so politicized? And it took a while for us to get to the place to look at abortion through the prism of the Roe v. Wade decision. And that was the point in which, you know, we cut away a lot of fat in the film, and we said, if it doesn't relate to the Roe v. Wade decision, it has to go. And so that's really the starting point.
Let's talk about the history of abortion rights in the country, because I think a lot of people don't really understand that its history seems somewhat counterintuitive, that some of the people who were the biggest advocates for abortion rights decades ago were Republicans, and they saw it not only as kind of a personal choice issue that the government should not be intruding in your life, but there was also kind of some tie-ups with Roman Catholicism and what Republicans were responding to. When do you think it really became a political topic, and how did the people who first embraced abortion rights start running against abortion rights?
Well, I actually want to back up for just a second, because I think to the question of when did it start to become kind of this political action point, what was interesting is when the state started basically passing what were considered to be abortion reform laws. Mm-hmm. You saw in California, Reagan, surprisingly, for many people now, signed a liberalized version that allowed certain abortions in the state of California.
Whereas New York was incredibly strict.
And New York was incredibly strict. And at the time, this was late 60s, this was prior to the Roe decision, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, the Catholic Church had always had a fundamental, you know, it's consistent within the religious teachings that conception is life. And so they'd always had that as part of the religious structure. But for the first time, there was an actual letter that created what became the foundations of the National Right to Life Committee. It was an instruction to the lay elements of the Catholic organization to basically start getting political. And it was an interesting pushback, and you really saw it play out in New York, because New York started, you know, under Governor Rockefeller, started to get a little bit more liberal in terms of abortion reform laws. And the pushback from the Catholic Church was significant.
And one of the things that you document in your film is how politicians make 180-degree changes in their positions about abortion, including President George H.W. Bush. What does he say, and why does he change course?
There was a lot of pressure. And we see first with Ronald Reagan and the actions of political strategists who really ultimately Ronald Reagan, who had signed one of the early, most liberalized abortion reform acts, what came out and had to be pro-life at that point. And but with George H.W., again, I think he was trying to, his family had been very supportive of Planned Parenthood in Connecticut. Their family, his father, Prescott Bush, had actually been a great supporter and founded the first Planned Parenthood in Connecticut. But there was a lot of pressure. And originally he said about the Republican Party, there's room for both pro-choice and pro-life people in this party. We do not want to politicize it so that, you know, we are only a certain pro either side in the Republican Party. But over time, he realized he was not going to get the vote. He was not going to get the support, ultimately, of a core group of voters. And he came out very pro-life. And it was in order for him to win the vote.
Yeah, and I think to add to that, it comes down to political strategy. Because you start to look at sections of the country that vote along single issues. And as we show in the film, it became a very effective motivating tool to get certain people to vote. And I think when push came to shove and he looked at certain sections, in particular in the South, that were up for grabs, it became a very expedient choice to make that decision. But I just want to go back for a second. When you think about where people were politically versus looking at this as a public health issue, under Nixon, you have Title X. You actually had funding for family planning. You had funding that basically encouraged education about sexual health and about contraception. And these were Republican leaders who were basically looking at it, to be honest, from a population perspective. And they were really fundamentally interested in the health of their nation, the health of the planet. And by the time you have Herbert Walker Bush running for office, it is a fully politicized vote-getting strategy.
Coming up, more from Reversing Roe filmmakers Annie Sundberg and Ricky Stern. They recall a time when abortion was illegal in this country and wonder if we have collectively forgotten what that meant.
KPCC podcasts are supported by UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting political pundit and cultural raconteur Fran Lebowitz in conversation with Matt Holzman, Sunday, September 30th at 7 p.m. at the Theater at Ace Hotel. A sharp-tongued social critic and keen observer of the irony of human behavior, Lebowitz is often described as a modern-day Dorothy Parker and is known for her sarcasm, wit, and outrageous positions on current affairs and contemporary culture. Tickets at cap.ucla.edu.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. In 1973, the Supreme Court made abortion legal in this country with its landmark decision known as Roe v. Wade. That ruling has come up a lot today in the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing on the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh. If he makes it to the court, Kavanaugh could possibly be the fifth vote needed to overturn Roe. It's amid this debate that Netflix will be releasing the documentary Reversing Roe, made by filmmakers Ricky Stern and Annie Sundberg. The movie traces the history of abortion in the United States and how it became a religious and political issue. I spoke with Stern and Sundberg this weekend at the Telluride Film Festival, where their documentary premiered.
Early feminists understood immediately that abortion was a central issue to feminism and to women's rights.
What do we want? Free choice! You want it now!
If you didn't have control of your own body, we weren't sure what kind of right you could ask for.
It is a political issue. The state means to control our bodies. We produce the soldiers, we produce the workers, and they fear the loss of that control.
I think it's fair to say that your film comes at this subject with a bias in support of abortion rights. Do you think that's fair?
Can I ask you why you say that?
Because I think the voices that we hear certainly are advocating that a reversal of Roe is a very bad thing and will have very harmful effects on the health of women in the country.
I think what we tried to do I think that is probably fair, but I think what we really tried to do was to look at the issue from both sides. And it's interesting when you have a law that allows you something like legalized abortion. I don't want to say there was a complacency, but maybe some would argue there was, and like, well, we have it. It's a Supreme Court decision. And so, you know, fighting to keep something that you already have is very different than fighting to change it. And so there's been this very strong movement of pro-life to overturn Roe v. Wade. And I think the pro-choice side of it really is trying to say, listen, if this is overturned, let us caution you, let us remind you of where we were when Roe was not law of the land and when abortion was illegal. And so that is really, I think, ultimately where you get to in the film, which is let us explain to you how we lived when abortion wasn't legal in America.
What we really honestly tried to look at is historically, what was the context that led to Roe? What was happening in this country? What were people paying attention to? And people were paying attention to wards off the emergency room where women were having complications from self-induced or illegal abortions, and women were dying. And I think that there is, in this country, a little bit of a short-term memory in terms of just what that means. And so if you perceive a bias, I think that's, as women, or at least as a woman, that's where I'm concerned.
I just want to say the second part of my question was, if you come into the film with this bias, how are your beliefs challenged by the other side of the argument? Where did you see yourselves reexamining what you believed and challenging your own assumptions about the debate?
Well, I would just say personally, you know, I don't think we have these conversations enough with people who have different views and values that are perceived around this issue. And I think that's the problem. I think that it's become so politicized and so partisan. We feel like it has become to a point now where you really can't even have the conversation.
So does that mean that you hope audiences who see this will challenge their own assumptions, maybe open themselves up to seeing the issue from somebody else's point of view? What do you hope the audience takeaway is for this?
For us, one of the things that we really look to explore is this intersection between both abortion as how it became politicized and the intersection with religion in our country and how those two things are used. And I think that as people look at this, you know, people might be engaged on either side of it. But in terms of changing one's belief, I think it's tricky. We came up against this end over end when we were looking at this as filmmakers. Ask the same question a different way, you'll get a different answer. If you ask people fundamentally across the board, even today, even heading into, you know, where we are now with this administration, the potential for a fifth conservative justice on the Supreme Court, if you ask Americans, the Gallup polls, everything from July of 2018, do you want Roe to be overturned? No. Do you want abortion to be legal in all circumstances? Things start to get a little bit muddier. And I think that those are the conversations I think we should be having as a society. And I think that we should figure out how do we support a dialogue on that as opposed to something that becomes such a black and white yes or no shouting match across the line.
Ricky and Annie, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Annie Sundberg and Ricky Stern. Their documentary Reversing Roe premieres on Netflix on September 13th. And now a conversation about another film that premiered at the Telluride Festival over the weekend, White Boy Rick. Directed by Yann Demange, the film is based on the true story of Richard Wershe Jr., better known as White Boy Rick. In Detroit in 1987, when Rick was just 17, he was sentenced to life in prison without parole for cocaine possession. What wasn't known publicly then was that Wershe had been working as an FBI and police informant since he was 14 years old. The title character in White Boy Rick is played in the film by first-time actor and teenager himself, Richie Merritt. Matthew McConaughey plays his father. I spoke with Matthew McConaughey and Yann Demange before an audience at the world premiere of White Boy Rick in Telluride, and I asked Demange about the Michigan law that sent Wershe to prison for life.
I didn't take on this story because I wanted to talk about mandatory sentencing. If I wanted to talk about mandatory sentencing, I think you'd have an ethical and moral obligation to tell a story about an African-American because those laws have absolutely decimated their communities. Now, with that particular law, it has since been deemed inhumane, unconstitutional. Everyone's been let out except for Rick. With Rick, he got too close to the political elite. he was being used by the FBI and their campaign to go after the African-American political establishment. He did his bit. He betrayed people he loved. He got used. The only friends he ever really had, he informed on. Mm-hmm. You know, the relationship with his family was broken. And he's been inside since he was 17. Mm-hmm. Okay? That can happen. It's outrageous. But we know that worse happens. So that's, and he's aware of it. That's why he doesn't play the victim card, because he knows worse happens out there. So it's not a campaign film for him. There are other themes at play.
You have to cast an actor in this part who's going to carry the film, and he has to have the spirit of Rick. How do you go about finding Richie Merritt? How long did it take, and how did you know...
I love this difference.
...that you had your Rick?
It was tough. I mean, you know, it was a two-pronged attack. We had to read every known and unknown actor from here, the UK, Australia, anywhere they could speak English. Lots of actors you'd know and love. And also, from the very beginning, I was like, as well as that, we should be doing street casting, which I've done many times before, to some degrees of success and not so much. It's always a risk. But I did it with 71, I did it with a show I did in London called Top Boy, because you're seeking authenticity. And I was concerned, you know, about finding a teenager that could be truly transformative and embody something that he's not from to this extent. I mean, it's hard for any actor, you know, seasoned actor with all those tools. So I was like, we need to find someone that's authentic. And also, as you know, in America, it's so segregated. It's tough to find working class white kids who genuinely live and mix with African-American communities. It needed to be someone that could really embody it and own it and not be faking it. So we started a non-actor search, and the guys that did American Honey were looking for me. And they were very good. They cast a wide net, many, many states, still a lot of towns, Buffalo. This kid was found in Baltimore. And the particular scout was at this school, and they were targeting areas, and like I say, where there was a degree of mix. And she went to the school, and she talked to the principal, and they're like, what the f***? What film? What? You know, just like, this is just absurd. And like, she came out, she said, and there's this kid waiting to go and see the principal because he got into some s***.
He had been called into the principal's office.
Essentially, yeah. Won't tell you
like
why,
the
but
time
like
that week, right?
Yeah, exactly. He was like on the verge of getting kicked out anyway. He's like, and the principal just went like, not taking it seriously, went, well, you can start with this kid. And he's in the movie.
And then it, to carry on after that, I mean,
he didn't even know who Matthew was, by the way.
No. But I mean, this young man, though, the boot camp that Jan put him through, it was great to see on the sidelines. It was, in a lot of ways, you know, there was from my perspective, there's something that I saw that I know you saw even before I did, that this young man, Richie Merritt, family meant a lot to him. His brother, his father, his mother, stepmother, it meant a lot to him. And his family's broken up, but it meant a lot to him. So anytime on set, if he was getting off or losing concentration, I could go to him on family, and it'd bring him back down to the ground. The other great thing that I think about him was that he had enough of, I don't give a shit that this is a movie and I'm in it in him, that there was a 20% chance every night that I was like, he might get on a bus and go back to Baltimore and stay right here. Which was great for the part.
Every time we had a hard day, Matthew was like, you know he might not come back tomorrow.
Coming up, more from Yann Dimash and Matthew McConaughey about their movie White Boy Rick and how they worked with an actor who had no experience. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Let's return now to my conversation with director Yann Dimash and actor Matthew McConaughey about their new movie, White Boy Rick. This was recorded in front of a live audience at the Telluride Film Festival, where the movie premiered over the weekend. In the film, McConaughey plays Richard Wershe, the father of a teenage boy known as White Boy Rick. He was sentenced to life in prison for cocaine possession in 1987, and at the time, he was just 17 years old.
8 pounds, 14 ounces. Such a weight you were born.
First time I looked in your eyes, I knew you were going to be bigger than me. I knew your life was going to be bigger than mine.
Look at this, Dad. Look how we're living. Let's hustle big. I know the players, and I know the game. Hey, come on, Dad. I can do this. We can do this.
The elder Richard Wershe passed away in 2014, but McConaughey and Dimash were able to meet multiple times with the real Richard Wershe Jr., who's been in prison for more than 30 years but might be released soon. In the film, White Boy Rick is played by first-time actor Richie Merritt. Here's Matthew McConaughey talking about what it was like working with a non-professional performer.
It means I cannot act. It was really something that was very exciting for me to go work with a non-actor because I knew... Look, you're acting, you know, the take, it should be live, and the first time every single time. But you understand the rhythms of scenes, you understand when coverage comes, you understand when a scene's working, and you're on the opposite side of the camera for somebody else, and you understand kind of when this, you know, you can kind of start to tee someone up with, you know, and still keeping it real, but a non-actor's not going to have any idea of that. So I knew, I was excited about every single scene. I'm going to have to get to Richie Merritt. Mm-hmm. Not Rick Wershe Jr. I have to get to this young man inside his heart and soul, which was really fun. It was fresh. Like I said, sometimes my relationship with him on the set and through the whole time, it was you know, between a hug and a kick in the backside.
Matthew was amazing with him. I mean, there's a lot of people... that wouldn't have been able to do that. It was taxing. It meant he had to be incredibly generous. He was my collaborator, actually, in eliciting that performance and getting those performances. Because, you know, like I say, there's a carrot and a stick. There was days where the kid did no concept of what was going on. And sometimes he was like, and at one point he said, look, I didn't want to be in a f-ing movie. F- you. And I was like, well, where do you go from there? Yeah. It's definitely carrot time.
I didn't ask for this.
It's like, you know, but that's what was wonderful about him. He wasn't going to try and go, oh, this is the moment where I can go for an Oscar, or this is the moment. He would be like, well, what about that? Nah, I wouldn't do that. It doesn't feel real. And you'd be like,
Matthew, I want to come back to this idea that you said when you were talking to Richie, you were talking about family, and every decision, for better or for worse, that characters make in this movie is really made for family. And about this idea of, are our children just the next generation of ourselves? How do they get to have a better life? How do we improve upon a situation that we're thrown into? How do we escape what the cards that we are dealt? And I'm wondering if that was part of what made this movie important to you as an actor, as a person.
Yes. Look, I've never tackled or embraced a character like this before in my career. This is my sad country song. This is a dog got run over the day my mama got sent to prison. You know, this guy loses. His heart's in the right place as a father, but he is born ill-equipped. He's ill-educated, like many people, in poverty, reciting nostalgia from the past and only living on the hopes of the future. Therefore, they're paralyzed in the present. The paralysis of poverty, single parent homes, dad living across the street, couldn't get his favor either. Now, maybe if he'd grandfather would have died 10 years ago, maybe Rick Wershe Sr. would have made something of himself. Father who wants to be best friends with his kids. Not the best recipe for being a good father. And there's a lot of people like that whose heart's in the right place, but they don't have the ability to do it. And there's a paralysis there, you know. Heart in the right place, but not the best of fathers.
Also, it's like, it was also a landscape that completely changed, as we all know what happened to Detroit, right? So it was the picture postcard of the American dream. You could better your circumstances, right? The big debate right now. You could improve upon your parents' position or status, or however you want to put it, if you just hard work. And that was, Detroit was the picture postcard for it. And overnight, the landscape changed and the rules of engagement changed. Mm-hmm. And to a certain extent, you know, the father, you know, the Bruce Dern character, the Matthew, there's this disconnection because the Bruce character, well, he had a job for life. Right. And he knew how to get along in life. And the world changed. And the values and the rules that he bestowed upon his son, Ricky's father, they were no longer, you know, valid. You couldn't just get a job, hold it down, and you'll transcend your lot in life and your life would improve.
The landscape also factors, Matthew, into something that your character says, which is lions don't leave the Serengeti. Why is that line important? Where does it come from? And why do you think it's something that he feels?
Well, in my earlier answer when I was saying, you know, the paralysis of poverty and people that you're hanging on and you recite over and over the nostalgias. This is, again, heart in the right place. We don't leave. My dad didn't leave. We're staying here. You stick to it. A dreamer who just can't pull it off, but going to keep saying the right things. Going to keep saying the right things. Going to hang on because maybe we'll get lucky and come out this time. Right, champ? Come on. Right, champ? We can do this, right?
There's values in it, not giving up.
Yeah, he was not a quitter. Rick Wersey, senior. He wouldn't quit. You can't fault his persistence. But it just got vacuous after a while. And, you know, and I think he was, and when he turned his back there at the end and he knew what his son was doing, he was biding time. Mm-hmm. He said, come on, man, we might get out of this. I just played my last hand, man. We might get out of here before they bust up the poker party. No, didn't happen.
Matthew and Yan, thanks for coming. Thank you guys for sticking around.
And that's our show for today. Remember to follow us on Twitter and Instagram. You'll find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.